Okay, good morning and welcome everyone. Thank you very much. I'll tell you quickly two things. First of all, very good to see you all. I think you will all recognise that the purpose of this seminar, I suppose you call it, conversation anyway, is to encourage and stimulate a constructive dialogue about what are genuinely very difficult issues about which there are really quite different points of view, and to encourage an atmosphere of exploration of the options that will be available to the incoming government after the forthcoming general election. We've got a number of six very distinguished speakers. We're very grateful to them, very fortunate that they have agreed to come. We are trying to be disciplined with regard to time. They have, hopefully, 5 minutes each to make a swift opening presentation of their views, and then we'll come open to questions, and we'll try and have a quick re-summary from them at the end. So if I could, as you will appreciate, particularly for speakers of this experience and distinguishedness, being very sharp with them on time. So could I encourage those who want to participate, ask questions or make a comment, to be equally succinct, because that's only fair. So without more ado, Nick Harvey is the first person I'm going to ask to contribute. Sorry, Nick.
Sorry, Jen. Before you go, I'll just introduce the paper.
Yes. I do beg your pardon. That's not what it says on my piece of paper, but I don't.
I'm sorry. So we're already departing from plans. This is the nature of these sorts of activities. It's the nature of government too. My name's Paul Ingram. I'm the executive director of BASIC. We have produced a draft ministerial submission, which you should have in front of you, which is a fictitious submission dated the 8th of May. The new government is coming in. We have no idea of, obviously, as we sit here, what colour or colours that government will be. But they face, whichever colours they are, they face a very important decision, or set of decisions. Those sets of decisions involve the crash creation of a national security strategy, because there hasn't been as much preparation for this as the National Security Committee chaired by Margaret would have liked by now. They have a comprehensive spending round to kick off and conclude, and they have, of course, a defence and security review to do, all in the space of a few months. And right at the heart of that is the decision on whether to go forward with the renewal or replacement, depending on one's perspective, of the Trident system. The main gate decision is due in 2016. So that's the context. There are significant Ministry of Defence cuts on the cards unless there is a change of direction. We've experienced something like 8% in the cuts in real terms over this government, and projected cuts of potentially up to 10% in the defence budget. We have previously the National Security Strategy of 2010 categorised strategic threat to the UK as a tier 2 threat. Another, of course, on the other side of that equation is that we have the emergence of a challenging neighbour to the east, Russia, and a renewed focus on the capability of NATO. And finally, well, as I say, we have the Strategic Defence Review, the Security and Defence Review, and the CSR on board. Now, we have, of course, already had a Trident Alternatives Review. It was published in July 2013. And that went quite exhaustively through the alternatives, the nuclear weapon alternatives to Trident. And without coming to a conclusion, it clearly implied that there were no other cheap alternatives to Trident. But these were based on assumptions that I think the government would do well to look again at. The first being that it would take Aldermaston 24 years to construct a warhead-friendly alternative system to Trident. That seems a rather long time, given that we're sitting here worrying about Iran today. And Alder Marsden has 7 decades of experience, £1 billion worth of investment each year, and it has a very close relationship with the Americans. The next assumption is that we would need an independent nuclear arsenal. Now, I think that's worth reinvestigating, because in the face of a Russian threat, we need to be thinking about alliance capabilities, and that needs to be a far more important issue, how Britain significantly contributes to an alliance that provides European security effectively. We also had the assumption that a minimum credible deterrent was one available at very short notice that would deliver a significant scale on any potential enemy with a very high level of confidence. I think it's time for us to revisit that minimum credible deterrent, because looking into these considerations, are we actually looking at a deterrent, or are we looking at assuring our population? Because assurance requires a far greater level of nuclear capability. If we go back to 1978, height of the Cold War, the government received in confidence a report commissioned and then delivered by Duff Mason. And their conclusion was that in order to deter the Soviet Union, which would require what one imagines a much greater level of deterrence, you would need to destroy 10 Soviet cities, not including Moscow, or land 30 warheads on that country. That's a much lesser level of deterrence than the one that we're using today, apparently. We need to think about the relationship with the United States. We've already this week had the Chief of Staff of the US Army criticising this country for moving down probably below 2% of defence spending. And we need to be thinking about what is good for our relationship with the Americans. We also need to be thinking about, as I say, about NATO and Russia, the signalling that goes behind an alliance that looks far more on assurance than deterrence. Should we be thinking about facing Russia alone in a Hitler 1940 situation, or should we actually be more realistic and think about alliance capabilities alliance-wide? Do we really need continuous at sea deterrence for the Brits, for the French, and 5 submarines at sea for the Americans when we're facing an adversary that is using completely different tactics? And finally, we need to be thinking about the Non-Proliferation Treaty and our responsibilities to provide leadership as one of the 5 nuclear weapon states towards a world free of nuclear weapons. So the options we will be discussing today include like-for-like renewal along the lines that we have today, on the basis that this is a minimum deterrent, that we might consider relaxing continuous at sea deterrence. Continuous at sea deterrence is not a black and white thing. It's not you either have it or you don't. It's about confidence levels and risk. We might consider the option of further delay on the basis that perhaps the just as was assessed in 2010, the timetable is not as tight as we originally thought, and that there are very good reasons financially and for other reasons for considering further delay to the programme. We might be thinking about completely different platforms, perhaps attack class submarines with cruise missiles, aircraft with freefall bombs, or some other type of delivery system, or we might actually choose to abandon nuclear weapons altogether. So the recommendations you'll find in this ministerial submission recommends, firstly, that investment decisions are not rushed into in the first few weeks of the new government, that we reopen the classified Trident Alternatives Review that has all the data necessary, so it wouldn't require a long, drawn-out process, and to ensure that this Trident Alternatives Review 2, so to speak, informs the Defence and Security Review wholly. And then I've set out a list of terms of reference for this Trident Alternatives Review 2 that involves sliding scales of confidence and capabilities, looking again at the time to construct a new or modified warhead, looking again at the independence of the UK, of the UK nuclear deterrent, and whether actually we need to be thinking more in terms of our contribution to alliance capabilities, and fourthly, to look again at the holistic foreign policy implications of the options. Finally, I would like to say that this is on the record, this meeting, and that people are invited to tweet on this hashtag as we move along. Trident Options. Thank you, Margaret.
Thank you, Paul. As I was saying a few moments ago.
Yes. Margaret, thank you very much, and thank you, Paul, for setting out so lucidly the issues that you think are pertinent. I think your draft memo does indeed give us a very useful agenda, and I'll say a few words, if I may, about each of the points you've referred to in turn. But the first I want to pick up on is your supposition that the decision about renewing the Vanguard submarine fleet will, I think, be, as you put it, at the heart of the SDSR, which will follow the election. Oh, that we could rely on that being true. The nuclear deterrent was not addressed at all in the 2010 SDSR, and if the same people are running the operation this year as did then, I think it is their intention once again to omit this completely from the SDSR process, which to my mind is ridiculous, because the SDSR happens to coincide with the once in 25 or 30 years moment when a decision has to be taken about replacement of the submarine platform. And it would be absurd, with all the painful decisions that are potentially going to have to be made in this SDSR and the comprehensive spending review which follows, for the biggest single item to be left out of it. In my view, it must be part of the SDSR, and the proposed investment in replacing the submarines should compete for the limited resources alongside all the other programmes that will be on the table. Now, I believe there is some scope for delay, but I don't think that that scope is infinite, both because I think keeping the old submarines going will get increasingly expensive with obsolete parts, but more because of the impact it would have on Barrow if we don't have something to put onto the order books at Barrow beyond the 7th Astute. We run the risk of making the same mistake all over again with Barrow that we did the last time, where we allowed the production line and the labour force to collapse, and then it cost an enormous amount to put it back together again. So I think the next government, before the end of the five-year term, is going to have to order some more submarines, whether it's additional Astutes, whether it's the proposed successor or something, or else we're going to have an industrial disaster there. Now, my view is that, starting from where we are today, it probably does make sense to go forward with the successor design and order at least two of those. But to get my wholehearted support for that, we would have to ensure that the design was so refined as to make the submarines capable of other uses as well as fulfilling the nuclear role. The Americans use the equivalent size of submarine for having conventional weapons on board as well, and they can also send special forces in small units out of those submarines as well. They have taken some of their submarines out of the fleet and used them for these alternative purposes. I'm not suggesting multiple use all at once, but if they're going to have a 25 or 30 year lifespan, I personally would want to ensure that they were future-proofed and capable of using these other capabilities. I don't think it makes sense to replace like for like. We calibrated our current system, as Paul said, at the height of the Cold War. The threat today is of a very different magnitude, but I think we should have a flexible posture in terms of our patrolling. I don't think at the moment there's any need whatever to be patrolling 24/7. We don't have a known nuclear adversary at this time, but I think we have to be capable of mounting a patrol if we think that we are facing a threat of that scale in the future. And we would have to be capable of sustaining it for a period of time, so we need enough of a nuclear capability to be able to do that. Now, Toby Fenwick is going to introduce in a minute his ideas for an alternative platform. I think we should retain an open mind to alternative platforms. I think there are some obvious questions that arise from his suggestion of an air-based system. I wouldn't fancy being the one to break it to the Royal Navy or the Carrier Alliance after all the sagas of the cats and traps, that at this late stage somebody had come along with an idea of putting cats and traps in after all. But I think these ideas are worth looking at, and I share Paul's scepticism about the timeline that effectively thwarted the idea of an astute or a tactical submarine-based system. So my view is that there are alternative postures that would allow us to procure a slightly smaller system, which would cost less. I think it would be a valuable contribution towards disarmament. I think that the possibility of an alternative platform altogether shouldn't be completely disregarded. It's certainly worth exploring further. But my critical point is this absolutely has to be at the centre of an SDSR this summer.
Thank you very much. George Robertson.
Okay, thanks, Margaret. I'm all in favour of a memorandum for incoming ministers. I think that it makes sense, perhaps, to do it, and inevitably one will be constructed in the system at this minute anyway. But I think that memorandum to the Prime Minister, effectively, should say very, very different things to this draft that's in front of us today. First of all, Prime Minister, I would say, recall that both the Conservative and Labour parties are committed to continuous at-sea deterrence, the continuation of Britain's independent nuclear deterrent and continuous at-sea deterrence, that the Liberal Democrats, and Nick Harvey has made it clear, that they believe in deterrence, and he has said today that they would go ahead with building two of the Vanguard class, new Vanguard class submarines. So we're not into the business of saying doing away with it. Three of the major political parties are saying that, and even the Scottish National Party, which pretends to have a role in the UK government after the election, signified last year that it would join NATO, and independent Scotland would join NATO, and NATO is a nuclear alliance. If they were going to apply for membership of NATO, they would have to accept the fact that there was an alliance nuclear umbrella over it. So the Prime Minister needs to be told that right at the very beginning before any other decision is taken. He should be told, Prime Minister, that in the coalition agreement at the beginning of this government, the Liberal Democrats insisted on a review of all of the alternatives to continuous at-sea deterrence and to the Trident system. And therefore, the Trident alternative review was conducted for the Chief Secretary to the Treasury, and it reported in July 2013. And we should be reminded of what the Trident alternative review actually said. Because it was it exhaustively looked at all of the alternatives that have been put forward, and it says none of these alternative systems and postures offers the same degree of resilience as the current posture of continuous at-sea deterrence, nor could they guarantee a prompt response in all circumstances. That was in July 2013. Now, the opponents of continuous at-sea deterrence were not satisfied with that very, very thorough report. So BASIC set up the Trident Commission. They handpicked the people who would be on it. Martin Rees is present here today, and he was a member of it. BASIC refused to allow any of us with firm supportive views and continuous at-sea deterrence to be on it. I was told at the time that they didn't want people who were preordained on CASD before they come on to do that. And the Trident Commission reported exactly a year after the Trident Alternative Review. And all of the distinguished people on that came to a conclusion. And it quite clearly said, based on the two key specific considerations, namely national security concerns and responsibility towards the alliance, the Commission has come to the unanimous conclusion that the UK should retain and deploy a nuclear arsenal with a number of caveats expressed below. But it makes it clear costs must be of secondary importance to the judgment over whether forsaking the UK's nuclear deterrent capability could open the country to future strategic risk. And then it says, and I emphasise this to the Prime Minister, the Trident SSBN system meets the criteria of credibility, scale, survivability, reach and readiness. While the Commission is not in a position to interrogate in depth the information and assumptions underpinning the review, we are opposed to proposals to develop alternative platforms and delivery systems with new warheads simply on the basis of possible but speculative cost savings. So another review, another report, another exercise in examining all of the alternatives comes to exactly the same conclusion as the Trident alternative review. So they exhaustively consider cruise missiles, and in both reports they say it would require a new warhead, that the Astute class submarines, which are not designed in any event for delivering nuclear weapons, would have to be some considerable distance from the target. The adaptation of the submarines would be very, very costly indeed. And there would be, and this is a critical point, there would be the danger of ambiguity of your submarines being at sea and any potential adversary not knowing whether they were carrying nuclear weapons or conventionally tipped cruise missiles as well. They dismissed freefall bombs, and as Secretary of State for Defence in the 1998 Defence Review, I did away with that element of the British independent nuclear deterrent. Simply nonsensical way of trying to deliver a deterrent. The F-35C, which is postulated as being the alternative here, is not nuclear capable and at the moment cannot be used on UK aircraft carriers. And Nick Harvey is exactly right, going back to the Royal Navy and saying we'll reconvert the carriers to have the catapults and the traps instead of what they have at the present moment, I think would be eye-watering in terms of cost. So either these alternatives don't work, or they are too expensive, or they would take far too long. So in the memorandum to the Prime Minister, I would hope that he would reject statements and unsupported assumptions that are being made by some people who continue to want the answer out of every review that has taken place up to now. And a lot of these assertions about whether or not a new warhead could be created in less than 24 years, that there are erroneous assumptions in the Trident alternative review. And remember that the basic Trident Commission re-examined all of the assumptions in the Trident alternative review. And those people who want yet another review, when we had one in 2006, 2010, 2013 and 2014, simply want another review in order to get the answer that has been rejected by all the previous reviews. I started my career in politics carrying a banner saying ban the bomb at Adnadham Pier in Dunoon on the Clyde when the American submarines arrived in the Stone Age of politics. I believe that if Britain gave up its independent nuclear deterrent, that we would set in chain a virtuous circle. So later on in my political career, when I was in charge of Britain's independent nuclear deterrent, I unilaterally reduced the British independent deterrent by more than anybody had ever done in history. Did it get any reciprocation? Certainly not. Because the Chinese, the Indians, the Pakistanis, the Iranians, and others, including the Russians, are now investing in new and better nuclear capabilities. So in a dangerous, dangerous world, we cannot make assumptions about the benign nature of what we do, sparking off benign reactions as well. And that's why I reject the draft memorandum that is in front, although one based on my proposals, I think, should be going forward to incoming ministers. Thank you, Margaret.
Crispin.
Margaret, thank you very much. Well, I begin where my colleague Gisela Stewart suggested we should start in the debate we had on NATO on Monday, which is that we should start thinking about what we think Britain's place in the world ought to be. And we have never really had a proper reassessment of exactly what our position in the world should be in the decades going forward. And I have watched as special advisor to Malcolm Rifkin, both in the MOD and the Foreign Office, and then from the observation on the Defence Select Committee when I got elected here in 1997, the consequences of the Defence Review carried out in 1998, which was pretty much a continuation of the strategy laid out in Options for Change at the end of the Cold War, with £1 billion taken out of the budget by Gordon at the last minute, or would, I think you negotiated that a half a billion, George. And then all the assumptions underlying that then disintegrate under the scale of conflict that the United Kingdom was then involved with over the subsequent almost two decades from that point. And to watch our conventional armed forces then be put under such continuous strain that in the end the consequence was an element of tactical, you might say, minor strategic failure on behalf of the United Kingdom, both in Basra and the way we were shuffled out of Basra, and in Helmand, where on both occasions we as a nation bit off more than we were prepared to commit to chew in order to achieve the objective. And it all goes back to a mindset where the United Kingdom sees itself as a sort of continuing great power, that if there is a major conflict in the world, the United Kingdom should be forefront of being engaged with it. And frankly, I question that assumption. We carry a significant kind of post-imperial cost for the mindset that we take as a nation. Now, Gisela in her speech said we need to make up our mind, and if we want to be a sort of greater Denmark, then we should at least say so. Well, I'm prepared to say so. I think Denmark's a rather admirable country. And as a soldier, I would find the Danes alongside us, as they were in Helmand, properly committed as partners, making their contribution probably well out of proportion to their size. And I think that is the kind of role that we ought to be doing, consequence of our scale. And that does pose serious questions about our current conventional capability. And the problem with the decision to renew the Trident missile and the Vanguard and the Successor class submarines is that with a defence budget of about 2% of GDP where it is now and dropping, it takes twice the size of the defence budget that it did in the 1980s when we acquired Trident in the first place. And that is an awful lot of conventional capability foregone if that budget is going to be taken out of the MOD budget. So we are left with a position where the army now is down to 80,000 regulars with 30,000 reservists. And one just looks at the army posture at the threats that we now face, with actually having to look credible in the face of Russian adventurers NATO's eastern boundary, and the fact that we actually have to compete now properly against an Islamic fascist state that has sprung up, which has all the attractions of the fascist states had in the 1930s of people going to fight and die for it. We are now in a much, much more as serious an environment in terms of threat than we were back in the height of the Cold War. And if we go back to the height of the Cold War, then the Washington Treaty in 1977, the NATO nations were prepared to commit to a 3% year-on-year increase in defence expenditure, which of course then led to us winning the Cold War. Well, so far, we're not in that position. There doesn't appear to be. The Prime Minister's commitment around 2% of GDP at the NATO summit in Wales. We're waiting to see whether this is actually going to be delivered, and it's still a matter open for debate. So I'm then looking for a deterrent capability that we can afford, and I don't think we can afford Trident renewal. And therefore, I look very carefully at the Centre Forum paper produced by Tony Fenning. He's going to speak to that. But I would say the point where we should really examine this is look at the way he demolishes the Trident Alternatives Review and the assumptions that underlie it, particularly in terms of the timing of the sustaining of a deterrent. And I don't think we need a continuous at-sea invulnerable deterrent. We need to put a question in the minds of our opponents, if we can afford to do so, about whether or not we would use the deterrent. And I think the form of deterrent proposed in the Centre Forum paper achieves that objective. I would put the $4 billion investment into the aircraft carriers to actually make them useful. We need aircraft that can fly off the aircraft carriers that actually have the maximum capability in order to project force. And putting on the aircraft carriers planes that can fly off them without cats and traps limits their capability. Having gone to all that investment in the aircraft carriers. And this is a way in which I can see we can take a number of tricks here of 5 more SSN submarines that are actually thoroughly useful in the conventional sphere. It gives us, if with the budgets to be redirected, the opportunity then to actually invest in the military capability. That is actually, we're actually going to have to be inviting people to go to the Baltic states to actually stand in harm's way, ready to deter Russia in its current posture. And we've got kit that we have acquired over the last decade and a half, suitable for Afghanistan and Iraq and elsewhere, not kit that is suitable for Northwest Europe. The final point I want to make is to pay tribute to my colleague, Dr. Julian Lewis, who has dominated the debate inside the Conservative Party, if not in the country, in the way that he has presented his case. And there is, of course, always a tendency when you have a brilliant person engaged in the debate, then simply to defer to them because they do all the thinking on this and they're assumed to know all about it. And certainly, as far as my parliamentary colleagues are concerned, there is a degree of trust in Julian's thinking, and there is the shadow of the 1980s overshadowing all of this. The Labour Party front bench is not allowed to think because of the consequences of the result of the 1983 general election, the longest suicide note in history. Their candidates are allowed to think, which is why 75% of them appear to be against it. However, but the politics. I'm making a debating point. But the politics. But the politics of this is a really difficult issue for the Labour Party because of the perceived political vulnerability against it. So the Labour Party isn't allowed to think. My party has contracted out its thinking over to Julian, and because it differentiated the Conservative Party from the Labour Party so successfully in the 1980s, there is kind of an ongoing assumption that this is what we should continue to do. And therefore almost an unthinking recommitment to the current posture that we have. I don't think we can afford to go on with the proposed renewal. I think it has massive implications for the conventional armed forces. Conventional deterrence is a very important part in the current climate of the deterrence we need to deliver. I think the Centre Forum paper gives a sliver of opportunity that we can continue to have enough nuclear deterrence. And I wish that we would be able to escape from the stasis in thinking over this politically, but I don't think we're going to be able to.
We are slipping a little bit in time, and I'm very conscious that other people would be able to contribute. Toby.
Right, good morning, everyone, and thank you for coming out on what is a beautiful day. We could all be doing other things to discuss this. I think the key for us is when we sat down to review our 2012 paper on alternatives to Trident, and then produced what Julian's Crispin's already referred to.
Please speak up a little bit.
Sorry, what Crispin's referred to as the I'll be up. Thank you. As the 2015 paper, is we asked the question: what is the credible minimum nuclear deterrence, and how do we do it as cheaply as possible? And this is, in fact, what Ed Miliband said that he wanted to do in his 5th of January speech at the launch of the Labour Party manifesto or campaign in Manchester. And I think, as Crispin's already said, the key here is one of opportunity cost. To go with a like-for-like Trident replacement is going to cost somewhere in the region of 25 to 35% of the equipment budget every year between 2018 and 2032, at a time that the conventional forces need significant recapitalisation, both because of the wars in Afghanistan and Iraq, and also because the Air Force and the Navy are on that cyclical pattern of getting to the stage where their equipment that was purchased in the 1980s, 90s, and the first part of the noughties is going to be replacing after 2025. At a time when no party is committed to 2% of GDP for defence, and I know that there are many in this room, Julian and Crispin amongst them, most advocate, most vocally in the Conservative Party, advocating for that commitment to be made, the question is very direct. Do we want to have the conventional forces that are able to meet the range of tasks that probably actually were outlined by George Robertson in SDR 1998, of being able to have one or more brigades operating in different parts of the world, a full divisional force. I would remind him that he had 32 frigates and destroyers in his fleet in 1998 as a result of his review, and now under 20. At the times when we have this much loss of conventional capability and we are taking away so much of the conventional capability to fund Trident, we have to come back to what is the minimum required. And this is where I think the TAR falls down on three major points. The first was that it didn't sit down and use the Duff-Mason criteria of 1982. They had been declassified at that point, and in 1982, Sir Anthony Duff, who was the previous JIC chairman, and Mr. Mason from the MOD, confirmed at the time that we were going to buy Trident 1 and the Trident 2 decision in 1982 that if we could destroy 10 Soviet cities, not including Moscow and Leningrad, or land 30 warheads in the Soviet Union, that would be enough for minimum deterrence. Now, this was a country being run by a former KGB boss at that point. Perhaps some things don't change so quickly. But the Soviet Union had far more coercive power over its people than Russia does today. So if it was good enough for the Joint Intelligence Committee in 1982, I would suggest that that level of deterrence is good enough today. The second thing that the CAR didn't do is it didn't consider the B-61-12, the forthcoming American weapon, which will be used for NATO and the dual-capable aircraft program. It's called a free-fall bomb, but it's better seen as an unpowered missile because it's got a range of 40 kilometres and it's precision-guided. And if you look at the famous chart A on page 7 of the TAR that, that George has in front of him, you'll find that there are no costings for the free-fall option in comparison with the other forms. The only thing that is aircraft delivered in that chart of comparative costings is an as-yet undeveloped supersonic cruise missile. It also requires purchasing 36 additional JSFs to carry it at a cost of some £5 billion. If you do both of those things and you wait 24 years for a new warhead, then you can sit down and prove that you need two SSBNs to cover the gap, and therefore it's all more expensive. This is the kind of reason that the TAR needs to be revisited. Finally, I think the question about does F-35C, is it nuclear capable? The answer is no, it isn't yet. Is F-35A capable of nuclear weapons carriage at the moment? The answer is not yet, but it will be, because without it, Tim, DCA, the dual capable aircraft program for NATO will no longer exist in 2025. This is why, you know, the paper includes the $350 million it would cost to make the aircraft capable if we bore all the cost ourselves. So I think we need to be realistic and, as Paul said in his introduction, look at this in an alliance capability. Ultimately, is it better for the Western alliance, for NATO, for Europe, and for our Commonwealth allies, for the UK to be a 60,000-man army, as Nick Hunter pointed out in the debate of the 20th of January, and having a very expensive, very capable, and second-tier threat system in Trident? Or is it better to have a fully engaged UK with global conventional capabilities and enough nuclear capabilities to contribute to NATO to the NATO alliance and to meet minimum deterrence? And for those who say, well, we want to have both, that's absolutely fine, but you're going to have to find an awful lot more money. And so, you know, whilst Julian Lewis and I suspect, disagree on many things, he has at least got the intellectual rigour to sit down and say, we need to be spending a lot more money on defence if we want to have it all. In the absence of that, in the 2015 general election, the memo to the Prime Minister in May is going to have to sit down and say, if you're not prepared to pay to spend any more money, let's have the correctly sized nuclear deterrent that allows us to maintain our conventional forces.
Thank you. Matthew Harris.
Thanks. I want to start by looking at this question of why exactly it is that the UK is considering the same question over and over, as a number of people have said already, because theoretically, the decision to proceed with replacement was reached in the white paper of 2006 and confirmed in the vote of 2007. It was looked at again in the Trident Alternatives Review. It was looked at again non-governmentally in the basic Trident Commission. And all of those reviews came to essentially the same conclusion, which was to proceed like for like replacement. And yet here we are having a similar debate again on the question of whether to open it all up again. So what is it that is making this happen? It strikes me that if you watched François Hollande last month, as he got up at the airbase in France where the French keep their air-delivered nuclear forces, and gave a 45-minute speech on the details of French nuclear deterrence. This was a sight you would not see in the United Kingdom, and you would not see the same reaction from the French public, which was essentially nothing. Not many people among the French public listen or pay attention to debates about nuclear deterrence, except for the instinctive idea that France is a nuclear power and should remain a nuclear power. But the British are different for some reason. So I wanted to highlight three reasons that I think that is true. The first reason is that Britain relies on a single warhead type and a single delivery vehicle, which means that these kinds of debates have a peculiar intensity because every decision on the future of the technology is essentially a decision on the future of the nuclear deterrent as a whole. On a similar note, the fact that the UK relies on a single warhead type and a single delivery vehicle raises the level of technological risk involved in the whole process, because if something goes wrong, there's not as much backup. I think the second thing that makes the UK different is the relationship with the US. The UK is the only nuclear power to have this particular kind of relationship with another nuclear state. And I think the effect of that relationship is essentially to make the status quo the most practically sensible option, because the UK benefits from drawing on US testing and maintenance of missiles. The UK draws on a common pool of missiles at Kings Bay, Georgia. The UK can collaborate on aspects of warhead design and a whole range of quite important supporting measures to do with materials, to do with safety and security, and so on. And the whole process is sometimes referred to as a process of peer review, that it's another, it's not just assistance, it's another voice in the design process. So I think that lends weight to the status quo because it reduces the level of technological risk and makes proceeding with what we already know a more sensible seeming option. I think the third thing that makes the UK different is its peculiar political relationship with the idea of unilateral disarmament. And this is something Crispin Blunt talked about and talked about in the debate on Trident a few weeks ago. And the fact is that the UK is the only nuclear-armed state that has had a major party of national government advocate for unilateral nuclear disarmament. But the problem is that major party of national government was beaten twice, and many believe it was beaten partly because of that policy, and that has a legacy that is felt very strongly today. I think because of the legacy of the 1980s, the case for unilateralism is not made as enthusiastically or widespread as it would be otherwise in the UK. And this is what makes the role of the SNP more interesting, because this is now, there is now an electorally relevant voice for unilateral disarmament in national British politics, which I think is something new. I think where all of that leaves us is in a peculiar situation where all the options on the table seem to have flaws of one kind or another. And in a way, the debate is about a competition of flaws rather than a competition of proactive arguments. Like-for-like replacement gives you the best single nuclear deterrence system that money can buy, but it costs a lot of money. £20 billion, roughly, to build it, and then £2 billion, roughly, to operate it, although that £2 billion would be shared in some ways with any other system. In Yes, Prime Minister, Sir Humphrey called the Trident the nuclear missile that Harrods would sell you, which I think is apt. But these days, I think it should be, it's better seen as the Rolls-Royce of nuclear deterrence, not least because Rolls-Royce build the reactors. The case for unilateral nuclear disarmament is probably the clearest moral case available. And it's the easiest case to summarise in a single sentence, which I think gives it power, which is essentially that nuclear weapons are immoral to use, therefore not credible to use, therefore we shouldn't have them. It is a clear argument, and I think that has a lot of power. The problem is that since 2006, the argument for the financial argument for unilateral disarmament has got stronger, and the security-related argument for unilateral disarmament has got weaker. The emergence of Russia as a revisionist power again has made it substantially harder to make that argument. And I think that's a real problem. As for the middle way, fewer Trident submarines, cruise missiles on attack submarines, freefall bombs on aeroplanes. I think the toughest question that argument has to face is essentially, why bother? Because the financial gains are important, but they're marginal, and it's not guaranteed that they're fungible, in the sense that that money may well go back into the treasury and not come out. So the various uses that that money could be put to may not actually be the uses that they are put to. I also think there's a problem in that some of these options lack a natural political constituency. Those who really care about nuclear deterrence tend to be drawn to the idea of continuous at sea deterrence based on Trident armed submarines. Those who really care about nuclear disarmament passionately are not that interested in the difference between four Trident submarines and two, for example. As for non-Trident options, and Toby, forgive me, this is going to be a bit facetious, but if the Trident option is like a Rolls-Royce, a non-Trident option is like a kit car, because it'll cost less money to begin with, but you don't know how much money you're going to end up putting into it while you're building it, and once you've built it, you're not entirely sure it's going to work.
We can come back on the
Yeah.
That doesn't matter.
I think the last thing I want to say is that I personally probably leaned closer towards the argument for replacement than for not. But the one thing I want to say is that if the UK is ever going to disarm, I think that it won't, and Paul, forgive me for saying this, I don't think it's going to come through as the product of a review. I think if the UK disarms, it will be because a political leader acts against the better advice of his or her officials. Because if you commission another review is going to tell you that the most practical risk minimising option is to build four Trident armed submarines and to maintain them. I think the second thing is that arguments for disarmament which assume that the UK can play the same international role with different capabilities are always going to be vulnerable. I think that if the argument for disarmament is going to be persuasively made, it needs to rest on the idea that the UK's role should change, and that part of the UK's role changing involves nuclear disarmament. Thanks.
Kate Hudson.
Thanks very much. I'm going to address option five, but I'd like to start by making some observations about the way in which this option's being framed, because I think it does little justice to the no Trident replacement option. Most importantly, I think it's out of step with the terms in which this debate is being conducted. And I mean that not only in terms of wider civil society, but also in terms of the current political debates that are taking place. And I think this option, as outlined, captures nothing of the dynamism, the legal, moral, strategic and security, humanitarian, and indeed financial concerns which dominate this debate and are leading so many people to change their minds about nuclear weapons from across many parts of society. And I think that the option of not replacing Trident is the real point for debate here. It's the real choice that's facing this country and, of course, the incoming Parliament, which will make that very decision. So I don't believe that it can just be either excluded from consideration in review as it has been so far, or tagged on the end of a rather esoteric list of options as we see today. I think it's the central question in a shifting political narrative. And I think that the incoming Prime Minister will not be well served if the balance of options presented in the memo is distorted in this way. I think that in the memo, the disarmament option needs to provide a thoroughgoing assessment of the reasons why Trident should not be replaced. I think it needs to avoid contentious and value-laden terminology, such as abandoning independent nuclear weapons altogether. I think most people think that they're not actually independent, so we need to stop using the term in that way. And how is relying upon the United States' extended nuclear deterrence somehow part of the disarmament option? You know, if anything, that should be outlined as a separate option. And with all due respect to the people who produced the memo, option five seems a bit like a nuclear disarmament option written by people who don't support nuclear disarmament. And I wonder if you are, or we are all aware, just how much opposition there is to Britain's possession of nuclear weapons from across our society. I know there's a bit of banter about this New Statesman report earlier, but only yesterday that magazine reported that 75% of a sample of Labour's parliamentary candidates oppose replacing Trident. That includes long-standing and new candidates in safe and marginal seats, including some of the party's safest seats. And this is, of course, a significant change. And as has also been mentioned by other colleagues, a number of smaller parties, and maybe not so small in the case of the SNP, are making this a red line issue for supporting a minority government. In another arena last month, the House of Bishops published their pastoral letter for the general election, including that shifts in the global strategic realities mean that the traditional arguments for nuclear deterrence need re-examining. So as a very minimum, they need at least to be re-examined. The TUC Congress has clear policy against Trident passed in 2013 and supported by Unite the Union, which, as we know, has members in the Barrow shipyard. And they say money saved by ending our nuclear weapon system could be used to sustain the process of defence diversification vital to our manufacturing future. And of course, the question of the opportunity cost of Trident, as others have mentioned, is absolutely fundamental to the discussion, whether it's for sustainable industrial development and job creation, for spending on the NHS, or for sustaining our troop numbers and their equipment, or dealing with the challenges of cyber warfare, terrorism, or climate change. If I can just touch very briefly on international considerations. Bizarrely, I found the reference made in the ministerial submission to the Nuclear Non-Proliferation Treaty was to point out that even if Britain got rid of its nuclear weapons, it would still be a recognised nuclear weapons state. And I wondered why it was felt necessary to include that observation. Surely the incoming Prime Minister needs to be reminded of Britain's obligation under the NPT to disarm its nuclear weapons. And he also needs to know that the overwhelming majority of states favour progress towards the abolition of nuclear weapons. Now, this is very clearly indicated by the recent series of international state-level conferences on the humanitarian consequences of nuclear weapons use. And I'm sure you're aware that attendance has been so high at those conferences because leaders have increasing concerns about the threats to their own nations and populations as a result of what many people perceive as a selfish insistence by a small number of states on possessing nuclear weapons. And of course, I was delighted, as we all were, I'm sure, that Britain attended the most recent conference in Vienna, and now our government needs to act upon those ideas. It's worth noting also that an increasing number of states, including from amongst our European allies, favour the initiation of a global nuclear ban treaty to outlaw nuclear weapons altogether. To conclude, it often seems to me that many politicians, no disrespect intended, often at higher levels, are immune to legal and moral arguments about nuclear weapons. But this has to change. And I think people would do well to actually listen to what people are saying in Britain and across the world too. And if I can revert to conclude to the bishop's letter, they make what I think is a very true point. They say, such is the talismanic power of nuclear weaponry that few politicians seem willing to trust the electorate with a real debate about the military capacity we need in the world of today. And this real debate is exactly what's needed, and I don't believe it can be framed in the old times jargon of an MOD that seems to want business as usual. It's time now for genuinely open thinking about Britain's real security needs.
Thank you very much. Now, the hope when this agenda was drawn up was that we would have maybe three quarters of an hour or so for general discussion. That has rather diminished. I reckon we've got about 22 minutes, something of that order. So I'm keen to get in as many people. I think it's been a genuinely stimulating set of presentations, by the way. But I'm keen to get in as many people as we can. So if I could urge people to be succinct, although I know it's not easy. Julian, that was your hand, I think I saw waving first.
Thank you, Margaret. I shall be succinct in the hope that we might be able to go around a second time. If the Basic Trident Commission report had come to the conclusions which Basic wanted, I don't believe we'd be having this session today. This is an attempt to rewrite the results of the report, just as it's an attempt to rewrite the conclusion of the Trident Alternatives Review, which took place only at the behest of the Liberal Democrats in the coalition. I'd like to thank Basic for inviting me along today. I'd like to, but I can't because they didn't. Even though it was suggested by my colleague Sir Gerald Howarth, former Defence Minister, that as the party's former spokesman on this issue for a very long time when we were in opposition, that they might invite me. But nevertheless, I look at the composition of the panel and I'm frankly worried. And the reason I'm worried is that although George Robertson doesn't need any help at all to make the case in favour of CASD and the successor programme, the fact that the only Conservative representative on the panel is my dear and long-standing friend, Crispin Blunt, who would be the first to admit that in the recent vote, which was held on the 20th of January on the motion that this House believes that Trident should not be renewed, 37 MPs voted for that motion, and 364 voted against, and Crispin was the only Conservative to vote for it. Now, that's fair enough. I respect his position just as he respects mine, but if BASIC were trying to do something on the basis of anything other than a foreordained result, you would have thought that they would have had room at least for a second Conservative representative on the panel. I'll leave it at that on there, and I'll just simply make the point about the alternatives that have been put forward. This magical process of Toby's says that somehow, by not building the four successor submarines, we're going to have enough money left over to build five SSNs, we're going to have enough money left over to tear apart the carriers, which are already well on their way to completion, and try retrospectively to rebuild them with cats and traps. We're going to have money left over for conventional forces. We're going to have money left over for free fall bombs to be dropped from aircraft. And at the end of all this process, we're going to come off continuous at-sea deterrence. And the point about mutual assured destruction was not only that it was mutual, but that it was assured. Once you take away the assurance that an attack will unavoidably be met by retaliation, then you open up the prospect of an aggressor gambling that he can get away with a first strike. And putting our deterrent on aircraft on the ground on carriers, and assuming, as your thing does assume, Toby, that you are going to have quite a bit of warning before the attack comes, is absolutely a recipe for disaster. I think I'd rather side with Kate and say, rather than do that, let's get rid of it completely.
Tim.
Thanks very much. I confess that when I first read the memo, I had to keep on looking at the date, because I thought I was reading something from 2010 rather than 2015, and indeed can only endorse what Lord Robertson and Matthew Harris has said about revisiting old studies. But just very quickly, some very quick comments on the four options open to us. First of all, like for like, could I please make a plea to everybody here? We keep on talking in papers, in the media, in Parliament, I'm afraid, about something called the Trident Replacement Programme and the like-to-like replacement for programme. There is no replacement for Trident. No replacement at all. Trident is a US missile system which is underwritten till at least 2042, and probably that's going to be extended to 2060. I was delighted to hear Sir Nick Harvey actually to refer to the only programme that is in town, which is the Submarine Successor Programme. It's very, really very misleading to the public who are not engaged in nuclear matters to call it a like-for-like replacement and a Trident replacement programme. Anyway, coming down the line of the four options, the relaxed CAS, Paul introduced that it's not a black and white issue. I'm afraid it is a black and white issue. It's about having either a credible deterrent or an incredible deterrent. And my own view is that running the part-time operation that the Liberal Democrats are proposing would not be a credible deterrent. And I think when you consider that option, you really do have to look at one level down. And I speak as a submarine operator here, ex-submarine operator, I have to say, you have to ask, how is this going to work? And when you scratch the surface and ask how it's going to work, it really is very, very difficult to see how that can sit comfortably with any credible deterrent option. But I haven't got time to go into detail about that now. The memo also asks for a further delay in the Vanguard class programme and a delay in the decision. Look, these submarines are hugely, hugely complex. It was described by my colleague Simon Lister, who is the boss of submarine procurement, that it's like a Swiss watch, only magnified 10 times. To glibly talk about delaying further is really not an irresponsible thing to do. These submarines have been already extended by 9 years. We have never, ever done that before. And the programme extending the Vanguard class is already very high risk. So going over yet again old ground to extend them even further would be a folly in my view. Finally, on the two alternatives to that have been suggested, cruise missiles in Astutes, we've gone over this time and time again. Us anoraks said way back in 2009-10 that it would be too costly, and that anyway, cruise missiles do not provide a credible nuclear deterrent option. But we've had a £3 million three-year study under the stewardship of a membership of the panel, and it came to the clear conclusion that the difficulties involved in procuring a cruise missile alternative were just not on. And as for Toby's valiant effort to table the F-35 alternative, so I'm not going to go over the ground that Julian has. I just have the vision, first of all, Toby, of this minister who's going to go and see Secretary of State in the US and say we are about to abrogate on our 50 years partnership of strategic partnership under the NATO alliance. We're going to step down from our agreements that we've got on the design of successor SSBNs, common missile department and all that, and we want to downgrade to a dual capable nation. And by the way, would you please sell us a bombshell? A bombshell, I have to emphasise. They would not be allowed to sell us the physics package under the non-proliferation treaty. And I'm afraid that your assessment of damage, of minimum deterrence criteria, is a valiant one, but I don't think had any access at all to any of the models of AWE Aldermaston, because they're quite rightly pretty highly classified stuff. And these are hugely, hugely complex and very, very difficult calculations when you start talking about nuclear weapon effects. And really, if you're going to involve minimum deterrence criteria, it's very, very difficult to do without access to some of the expertise and knowledge that is in AWE and others within government. So I found that a good try, but not convincing. And also, the whole of the cost data, hugely, hugely optimistic. We talked a bit about the CVF programme, and I agree with Sir Nick about the eye-watering changes of just the catapult, but we didn't even consider in your paper about the changes of magazines. If you're going to stow and handle nuclear weapons in aircraft carriers, that is a complete fundamental redesign, and BAE Systems would just hold their hands up in horror. And there's no costing for those in your thing, nor is there for the physics package. So I think Matthew Harris had it dead right, I'm afraid. If you look at these alternatives, Trident is a low risk. It is the same missile that comes out of Vanguard is going to go into the successor submarine. It is a low risk program in terms of cost and effectiveness, and provides the most reliable and effective nuclear deterrent capability in the UK, and any alternatives are just too high risk, so why bother? Thank you very much.
Tom Grayton.
Thanks very much indeed, Margaret. As one of the people who may be here at the time at which a decision is made, I'm interested to hear the debate. It's not one that I've really engaged with that much in the time that I've been here, but no disrespect intended to use your phrase, Kate, but I think relying on a partial survey of Labour candidates or the Unite the Union's annual conference decision as opposed to the GMB Congress's decision doesn't really help us, I think, in having the scale of the debate that, or the scope of the debate that we need, and so those like me who may be part of making a decision need to have. And you referred to Britain's real security needs just at the end of what you were saying. I think it would be incredibly helpful to have much more of your organisation's position coming from that perspective, rather than trying to play off partial surveys, because I don't think that actually helps get us very far in examining these issues. And I know, short of time and everything else, but it would be useful to get maybe more on that, if not today, then subsequently as we get towards the time for a decision.
David Hannock.
I just wanted to say a quick word about the international implications. Having heard the debate that's gone on this morning, I have to say that I do not think that most of the potentially benign international implications of either reducing the scale of Trident renewal or not doing it at all are real. I agree entirely with George Robertson. There is no indication that the Indians, the Pakistanis, the Israelis, the North Koreans, the Iranians are going to pay the blindest bit of attention to what we do. Their withers will not be wrung. And so I think, I'm afraid, that I think those arguments are really, they don't stack up. So to me, listening to this debate, and for that reason, I would conclude this is basically a domestic debate that has to be decided in this country on the basis, and there I agree with Crispin, on the basis of our view of Britain's role in the world. And I think that the wider considerations, which I personally share very strongly, I'm a supporter of Global Zero, I do not think that they should be prayed in aid in this debate much, because I don't think, as I say, that they stack up.
Well, I'd just like to point out that nobody's mentioned the term austerity, and nobody's mentioned public opinion. And I would like to ask the panel why they think Trident is excluded from the SSDR, and how things can change, and that it should be included, and also why, we've already had an answer why politicians are frightened of public debate, or we've heard that there's a large majority in favour, but as far as I'm aware, the public is the majority is against. So the question is, why is there not a greater public debate?
I think perhaps we can come back to that at the end, because I'm going to give all the panel a chance to wind up. Dave.
Thank you. I think there still hasn't been a lot of attention paid to the moral issue, and that has been brought up a couple of times, but it's something. There's a lot of my country that I'm proud of, but the fact that we have nuclear weapons isn't one of them. I would be much prouder if we were a country that actually decided to get rid of those things that endanger millions of people's lives around the world. And it's not just that we might not fire, we might fire them on purpose, but we could, they could be fired, they could be detonated by accident. And no mention has been made of that either. How close we've come in the past to nuclear annihilation through either accidents or through technical hitches. There have been a number of occasions where we've narrowly missed a nuclear holocaust. And I don't think that we can eliminate that possibility altogether, ever, while these weapons, while these things exist on the planet. So, to me, the only alternative, really, is just to get rid of the nuclear weapons altogether. And if we can't get rid of them from the world, and I believe we can do that, at least we can start with this country.
Is there anyone else at the table who wants to? Yes.
So I just wanted to say a little bit about Unite the Union, because I'm a relatively new MP, and before I became an MP, I was an active rep for Unite the Union. I think Unite have got quite a strange view on nuclear disarmament, because we've got so many workers who actually work in the industry. And Unite's view, certainly the policy conferences that I've been to, they've never actually come up with any sort of firm opposition. They've actually taken a middle line, because we are so conscious of it is a real issue about workers in the industry and the effect on workers were we to scrap Trident. And, you know, I think there's a lot of issues around the expertise that goes into into the deterrent, and we really do need to think very hard about the effect on communities that rely on that economy.
Can I just say, Unite also represents the workers in Derby, the Hounds, who make the propulsion systems. They're in a slightly different position, because a propulsion system can go in anything to a degree. But that adds to the complexity of the discussion. If there isn't anyone else at the table, you signaled, sir.
Thank you very much. In light of time, three quick bullet points. I think it's...
Who are you, please?
Sorry, Richard Guthrie. I guess I'm here at the University of Bath, but I have a history in this place. It needs to be foreign policy led, which I don't think we've had enough of a sense of Britain or what that world shape should be. It seems to be coming to two extremes almost. It is the disarmament or it is the fully fledged system. There seems to be very little in the middle ground. And while I am prone to the disarmament side, I think there is an inherent illogicality of wanting something like Trident system, but then not have continuous access to tariffs. I mean, the logic seems flawed within that. It's either all or nothing. And then the last is this suggestion made that it wouldn't be a review, it might be a leader's decision that ever went to disarm. I suspect that's also flawed because the disarmament process will take sufficient length of time that it would be relatively easily reversed if there wasn't actually an embedded political culture that wanted to pursue that. Because it would take 15, 20 years. So we're probably looking at a long-term decision rather than a quick decision.
If I could just make a quick point on that, and then I'm going to see if anyone else... I take your point, but I hope you're conscious of the fact that although it was Labour in government who committed us to a multilateral disarmament process, that has not been reversed by the present government. The policy has continued. Anybody else wanting to? Yes?
Duncan. The discussion has sort of focused on different ways of delivering a nuclear attack, essentially. What I find is very much somebody, you know, totally non-expert on any of this, is can anybody on the panel give me any indication as to what are the circumstances in which we would conceivably actually use any of this capability? Because I'm struck by, you know, given the renewed tension in the world, particularly in relation to Russia and Ukraine, it doesn't, as an observer, I haven't seen anybody suggest that our nuclear capability is remotely relevant. It would just be very helpful to know of any scenario in which the panel could envisage actually using this stuff.
Used every day.
Okay, I haven't got anybody signalling from the floor, so I'm now going to go to the panel and invite them to comment on what they've heard. If you could try very hard to keep it to a couple of minutes, that would mean that we are not breaking our commitment to people in terms of time. Nick, you were first, I'll take you first.
Well, I agree with Dave Webb that this is actually ultimately a moral issue, and I share David Hannay's view that our aim is global zero and that the United Kingdom should be sincerely committed to doing that. But I think it would be a very big ask in one go to move from having what Matthew describes as a Rolls-Royce system, and he's absolutely right, it is, and nothing, no alternative would be as good, I readily acknowledge that. I think it's a big ask to go in one fell swoop from that to a complete elimination of our nuclear capability, and to contemplate doing it at a time when our relationship with Russia, which is the most credible potential nuclear adversary, is self-evidently diminishing in front of our eyes. So I think that it is not basically possible politically at this time, and I'm not even sure I would advise it, to disarm completely. But I do question the need to be patrolling the seas 24/7 as though we were expecting an imminent attack. At the height of the Cold War, that made sense. Currently, it simply does not. And I think it would be a substantial and worthwhile step in the direction of disarmament if we were to adopt a flexible posture. Various academics have described a ladder of options ranging from continuous at-sea deterrence through near continuous to sporadic, right down to what I think would suit our current needs, which would be to come off patrol altogether, but have a well-rehearsed routine for mobilising patrols again if we felt that the situation deteriorated to the point that we needed them. I don't pretend that would achieve big savings, but it would achieve some. You wouldn't need the same levels of crewing. You would certainly be able to do it with fewer submarines. And I think that as long as we retain enough capability that we could surge back to patrols if we thought that the security picture deteriorated, that this would be a significant step down the nuclear ladder, but would still leave us with the capability we needed if things should deteriorate in the future.
Thank you. George.
Thank you. When I started my political career with a CND badge and a Committee of 100 membership card, I believe that the world would be safer without nuclear weapons, and I think, still think that that is the case. When I was in charge of the nuclear deterrent, I firmly believed that this was not a military weapon. It comes under the Ministry of Defence, but it's not a military weapon. It's a political weapon. It is designed not to be used. So those who sort of talk about the scenarios, perfectly valid, the scenarios have to be there, but the whole purpose is that you are trying to prevent other people from using it. So it is designed very specifically, right down to those who operated in the submarines, as a weapon of last resort for non-use. Now, if everybody in the world believed that we should do away with nuclear weapons, then that would be different. If we had a system in the world that allowed for disputes between nations to be resolved without nuclear weapons, then I would be in favour of that. But the world before 1945 and the invention of nuclear weapons was hardly stable, was hardly benign, it was hardly something that we would want to live in again. The fact is that we haven't had a major war like we had right throughout the centuries before 1945, precisely because nuclear weapons are there and because the cost of trying to win the conventional war is unimaginable for any country at the present time. What's the relevance, said Mr. Greenwood, about what's happening in Ukraine? In 1994, Ukraine, the newly independent Ukraine, agreed to give up all of the Soviet nuclear weapons that were on its territory in return for what is known as the Budapest Memorandum, whereby they were guaranteed by the United States, by Russia, by the United Kingdom, and by France and by China that their territorial integrity would be respected, that there would be no form of political or economic coercion against them in return for giving up unilaterally their nuclear weapons. And you only have to now examine what's happening to the independent Ukraine and what happened to the Budapest Memorandum, the guarantee that they got at that time. Madeleine Heard asked about public opinion. It's a fair question. But I think we should pay less attention to a survey of Labour candidates of a self-selection 12% who responded to the questionnaire that Mr. Foley actually sent out, and look at what public opinion is. The Select Committee on Public Administration, this House, the all-party Select Committee on Public Administration asked the question in 2013 about now thinking again about nuclear weapons. The United Kingdom has a sea-based nuclear weapons system using 4 submarines, which are reaching the end of their life. Some people say the government should order 4 new submarines. Some people say the United Kingdom should try to find a cheaper system for keeping nuclear weapons. Some say we should give up nuclear weapons altogether. The response to that, that sensible, clear question was 36% said order 4 new submarines, 31% said keep the nuclear system but find a cheaper system, and only 18% said the United Kingdom should give up nuclear weapons altogether. So it's a fallacy to say that some of these opinion polls that froth up from time to time with loaded questions are giving a high percentage in favour of giving up nuclear weapons. That, I think, is a studied response in a good question by a select committee of Parliament, and I think it sort of gives lie to the idea that public opinion is against it. I would finally say that there are certainly people in this country who would like to give up nuclear weapons and who don't see a role for nuclear weapons. President Vladimir Putin does not agree, because despite what we have done to reduce our nuclear arsenal, the Russians are now deploying 2 new types of submarine-launched ballistic missiles, a new class of ballistic missile submarines, a new type of intercontinental ballistic missile, and they're working on a new bomber and long-range cruise missiles. They're even contemplating building a new second type of ICBM, a big throwback to the heavy ICBMs of the past. China is deploying 2 new types of ICBM, is building a new class of SSBN and a new type of submarine-launched ballistic missile, and refuses to accept any limit on the growth of its nuclear forces. So that's the world that we live in. That's the real world that we live in. So giving up something at this time in return for nothing, despite the fact that giving up things in the past has produced no reduction in proliferation, I think would be a dangerous gamble to take. It would be a gamble taken by us on behalf of future generations who don't appear to have a vote in this at all.
Crispin?
Well, I'm delighted to note from the figures that George has produced, which I wasn't aware of, that whilst I may be the only Conservative MP prepared to vote in that particular direction, I do appear to speak for 40% of Conservative voters, which is mildly encouraging. I just want to very quickly address Dave Webb's point about the public, about the moral debate, and but really actually the legal question. I think the legal environment in which people take decisions about the use of force has markedly changed over the last two or three decades. We're obviously talking about a weapon system that would be used in circumstances in extremis. However, I think I'd be rather interested now in a Prime Minister writing instructions to the commander of the SSBNs, who would be writing instructions to put himself down in history as one of the greatest murderers of all time by the instruction he gave to the submarine. Now, of course, we're never going to know what instructions prime ministers give in those circumstances. But one just has to think about the fact that the environment in which these decisions would be taken has changed, both the wider legal environment and indeed the moral environment. But that is just a consideration, and there are considerations that go in the other direction, as George has pointed out, particularly by the capacity China's acquiring, and we're obviously seeing the threat to the United Kingdom and the global situation, particularly vis-a-vis Russia and what's happening around ISIS and a movement that's able to take ground, that the world situation is as difficult as it's been since I think the mid-1970s. But my basic point is that for the United Kingdom, there should be a triangle of consideration between foreign policy, our role in the world as we define it, the resources we're prepared to put to sustaining that role, and the defence capability that is then going to underwrite that role. Yeah. And the central problem with this weapon system is that it is going to consume what money is available for that defence capability in a greater way than has been done before, when this weapon system is of when its conceivable use is, I believe, much less than it ever has been than it has been at any time, despite the global situation. Quite difficult to see a United Kingdom standoff with China that might end up using these weapons. Indeed, I couldn't find a scenario when I tried to write one, apart from taking out some Gaddafi missile site miles away from a population centre, with a small weapon system, with a tactical weapon, when I was trying to work out what we might use it for. And it's the breakdown of the balance between foreign policy, defence policy, and the resources that this weapon system makes even worse than it is today, I think is the strongest argument for us to find an alternative, if we possibly can, even that alternative being doing away with them altogether, because at £109 billion of defence capability, I think this is, for a weapon that won't be used, this is not something we can afford.
Toby?
I'd like to pick up both the debate, but crucially what was said here by Madeline. For me, the issue is we need to make sure that Trident is in the SDSR and that it's tradable. And this requires a political agreement by incoming ministers saying that the money, if the MOD decides not to proceed with Trident, that the money will stay in the MOD's budget. Now, but George, this is a political challenge. This is for ministers like you to sit down with your Treasury colleagues and sit down and say, right, Treasury, this is what you said when Osborne made it clear that the 1980 Hansard was right, and that the agreement is that it will be funded out of the MOD budget, and that actually, if it is tradable, then we should be sitting down having that discussion. And that opens up the question of opportunity cost that Crispin has so eloquently put forward. It's extremely expensive. No one is questioning its capability, the dedication of the crews, the actual technical level of capability. I have great respect for Tim and his time driving around in circles or figurates of eight out in the middle of the Atlantic waiting for the end of the world. No one is questioning the level of capability. What we're saying is it's the opportunity cost against the rest of the against the rest of the UK conventional forces that drives this decision, I think. And you know, this is where The Economist was sitting down talking about detente Russia becoming Upper Volta with missiles. Well, we had to update that. I'd hate us to become Burkina Faso with missiles, because the simple question of is the world a better place with the conventional forces of the UK fully engaged? I'd say yes. I'm a liberal internationalist. I believe in our ability to go out there and make the world a better place. To George's question about what happened in the Budapest memorandum, I would ask him the question, you know, we were one of the guaranteeing powers, and what have we done on the basis of it? And the answer is we haven't done very much. And so the people of the Ukraine could reasonably ask the UK and the French and the Americans and the Chinese, well, we had this agreement and then you didn't turn up. So I think we had to look at ourselves on that question. Happy to take Julian and Tim's technical questions offline. The short answer is that we've always assumed there's going to be some level of strategic warning, and the UK manned ballistic missile early warning system at Fylingdales provides at least 4.5 minutes of tactical warning for a launch from Kaliningrad. Now, Julian, if you want to sit down and say that we're going to have some sort of random Spetsnaz raid against 18 UK Air Force bases and sink both carriers at the same time, really, I think we're talking about a different level of threat, and we're probably talking about a different order of threat. And I think, coming back to the points made by Crispin and by Nick, the issue is this is about Britain's place in the world and credible threats, not not things that I think probably are better in Tom Clancy novels. Finally, if you want a copy of the paper from Centre Forum, if you just email info@centreforum.org, we'll get a copy out to you. Thank you very much indeed.
Thanks. I'll try to be quick. Three specific things. Tim, on misleading people by calling it Trident, I feel your pain. My challenge to you would be, can you find something else to call it that fits in a newspaper headline and everybody knows immediately what you're talking about?
Fair point. Fair point.
I think on the question of international reactions, I think there's one thing that's missing, which for fairness sake should be raised, which is that you're not going to convince Iran, North Korea, Pakistan, India, and the rest by changing the UK's nuclear posture. There is more of a chance that you might change the attitudes of the moderate middle of non-nuclear armed states who are important to the non-proliferation effort. And that's where I think the UK's target audience internationally would be for changes in its own nuclear posture. The problem is that I think that the extent to which they would be encouraged by the UK reducing its posture slightly is small. It would be visible, but it would be small. And on the scale of arguments that we're weighing in this debate, I don't think it's influential. The last thing, Richard, fair point. What I was trying to get at was that if you ask the same question with the same terms of reference, you're likely to get the same answer because of the factors that make like-for-like replacement the safest, risk-minimizing option and the one that's most attractive to the people that have to operate it. What I was trying to get at was that in order to break that cycle, it will require, I think it will require political leadership that decides to ask the question different terms of reference about the UK's role in the world, about and doesn't try and substitute something else for Trident. Sorry, Tim. It doesn't try to substitute something else for Trident, but says we don't need it for the following reasons, and we're going to do something else.
Yeah, the jobs issue, absolutely very, very important indeed. That's why I quoted TUC Congress policy, which was supported by Unite, specifically addressing the jobs issue. Money saved by ending our nuclear weapons system could be used to sustain the process of defence diversification vital to our manufacturing future. Obviously, there's a bigger and longer debate we can have at another time. In terms of our partial survey, I'm pleased to say it's an ongoing survey, and we're getting new responses in every day, not only from Labour, but across the range of parties. So we look forward to sharing updates with colleagues as that survey progresses. Thirdly, we all have our favourite opinion poll results. Mine is one that was published in the Mail on Sunday a year or two ago, which showed that over 60% are in favour of scrapping Trident. Obviously, there's a kind of massive range of different responses you get from polling. And then finally, I absolutely support those colleagues who say that Trident must be included in the next Strategic Defence and Security Review, and the option of not replacing Trident has to be considered. It is an option there, it is an option that's on the table, and it's absolutely irresponsible for us not to address it properly.
Well, thank you very much, everybody. I think it's been a genuinely stimulating dialogue, at least I've found it so, anyway. I'm slightly surprised by the outcome, which is much more than I had anticipated, it seems to me at any rate, listening to the panel and listening to contributors around the table, much more clearly and starkly, and I think it was Kate who perhaps said it most bluntly, actually forget about all this stuff about how we could do this, we could do that, this would be cheaper, that would be better, da-da. It's yes or no. And it seems to me that that is the tenor of this discussion, that in the end what it comes down to, and yes, you know, people will continue to argue, no doubt, about whether there are other cheaper things you can do and so on as time goes on, but fundamentally the outcome of this discussion is you either stick with nuclear weapons or you don't. And I was interested that both Julian and Matthew, I think, no, it's Crispin, said that if we're going to sort of mess about, then let's just get rid of it. Let's bite the bullet and accept that it's yes or no, which I found interesting. The one thing that nobody else picked up that I would like to pick up, because it's something that's come out of the discussions of my committee, is something Crispin said, which is that, yes, there's an argument here this morning about whether or not Trident should be in the SDSR as an explicit question. But our argument has been, and David Hannay is gone now, but he's contributed to that argument to a degree, that one of the things we should do is identify where we think Britain is and should be in the world, draw up our strategic priorities on that basis, and shape the SDSR in the context of our strategic priorities. And of course you've got to take account of the finances, nobody questions that, but there should be strategic priorities, and then we look at what we can afford, and these are decisions that should be taken in the right balance, which is not easy to achieve, and it's not clear to me that at the moment we're achieving it. Thank you very much, everybody.
Thank you.
Thank you.